Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to make a start, if we may, as time is a little bit short. My name is Mark Russell. I'm the head of ship finance at Stevenson Harwood. And it's my great pleasure to be moderating this panel, looking at the banking side of shipping this morning. We've talked a bit about various sectors. Now it's time to hear about where the money is. We'll be talking a bit about the market, about what deals are being done, perhaps a bit about what deals should be being done, and also how different banks approach restructuring and challenging situations, as the euphemism goes. So there's quite a bit to get through. What I thought we might do to set the scene and put all this in context is to ask each of the panelists to say a little bit about the position of their bank in today's market. What deals can be done, what deals they are doing. Kristin, maybe I should start with you. DNB is, of course, a bellwether of the ship finance industry. Of course, we know you're open for business, but is this just core clients? Is it top-tier names, or is it something a bit wider than that?
You have to be with the clients in the long...
Oh, sorry. Yes. It helps, yes. You have to think long-term, and you have to be with the clients when it's tough and when it's easy. So when it's some of the segments, when it's tough now, yes, we work with the clients because we focus more on the clients and on the assets. So we do new business, but there has been, and this year, it's not been that much business. And if you look at the logic for the first quarter, it's basically 50% activity compared to last year. So there isn't that much business. But we have what we also see is a segmentation in the market with the top names getting or the top qualities getting good terms, and it's quite a competition on those transactions. Whilst when you go further out the scale, it's more challenging terms to be achieved.
Shreyas, is it similar position for Citi?
I would say business volume-wise, it's different for Citi because as a full-service global bank, our focus is really to deliver as many of our products as possible to the most sophisticated clients that we have. So, for example, with the price of oil where it is, it makes a lot of sense to focus on commodity hedging, and we've done a lot of that business this year. We continue to focus on global cash management. Globally on FX, there are challenges because of the way the margins have shrunk, and certainly on the trade finance side, as you see a widening of the gap between people who can get credit and who cannot get credit, trade finance becomes very interesting for supplier finance, for example. So, as a full service bank, we are seeing a lot of business coming our way on those areas. Pure ship financing, of course, is a much smaller business today.
Probably a good time to ask Bart to join in on this, because DVB historically has had perhaps a slightly different approach, much more asset focused, cash flow focused, perhaps a little less emphasis on the corporate behind the deal. I wondered to what extent that is still the case, and if it is, whether you feel that gives you some sort of competitive advantage.
Well, first of all, DVB has been in ship finance and will be in ship finance and is in ship finance. We have nowhere to hide, so. To that extent, we're very much like sort of the Greek ship owners here. Have we changed? I joined a year ago. Have we changed our focus? I don't think we have changed our focus. It's still, how can I say, it's more asset-backed than asset-based. I think that's the sort of a slightly change. And I kept saying to a lot of people in DVB, it's like, if I buy a Ferrari for my 12-year-old daughter, well, she's a bit older now. It's a beautiful car, but she will crash it. So it's, you can't just look at the asset. You have to look at who's actually behind the wheel. So yes, there's a change in mentality.
Yeah. And are you seeing much business this year?
It's like Kristin said, we're very much open for business, but there is just lack of global deal flow. I think we see 90% of everything, of all the deals out there, but it's just there's not enough out there.
Christian, what's the HSH position at the moment?
Yeah, well, it's our position. I mean, we are the biggest shipping bank in the world together with DNB currently, but the world is divided in a way because we have a significant domestic portfolio. Thus, when it comes to new business, we are more active on the international side. When it comes to restructuring, we are more active on the domestic side due to this legacy portfolio. We have been very active throughout the last 4 or 5 years. This year is not that active, as Christine already correctly said. There are not that many top transactions around, and fierce competition with regards to that transactions. Shipping will continue to be a relevant part of our business. However, in current environment, I think it's not the most important thing to do new business for new projects. For us, it's very important to cope with the current situation as it is, to cope with the portfolio as it is. There's much more money to earn on that side compared to do new business. But we are open to new business this year.
Hoost, the ABN position.
Always nice to be last. ABN AMRO is probably somewhere in between DNB and DVB in terms of strategy, and we are very much open for business. Nothing to add.
Well, you deserve a follow-up question for such a short answer. For any of the big shipping banks, obviously there's a lot of runoff with amortization on the portfolio. Do you find that puts pressure on you to do new deals just to stop the book shrinking because of that? Or is that an irrelevance?
You're asking me, yeah. Well, over time, that as you grow, I think, and that is one of the risks of being a very big shipping bank, as you grow and you become so big that you have become a significant player in the market, that will become, because, you know, reality is that we have to, our budgets will be pushed up year after year, so that will become an issue. We haven't faced that yet. We have been able to do the deals that we want to do, and we have never felt the pressure to do deals just for the sake of making our budget.
Okay. Thank you. We've talked a bit about the fact there aren't so many new deals in the market at the moment. The ones that are being done tend to be very much for the top tier names. That's where the liquidity is, and the point was made that the banks are almost fighting each other to do those top deals that are out there. What's the position for the people outside that top tier? Is there liquidity to be had?
I think, yeah, I take the liberty to answer first. First of all, we are open for tier one, tier two as well. Because we look at the project, we look at the structure, etc. And what means tier two? Is it in terms of credit worthiness? We have to look at the project, and you might be a little bit conservative structuring something for a tier two party. However, on the other side, when it comes to liquidity, I mean, the most important thing from my perspective is that equity is available for the same structure. And the problem with tier two or tier three names may be, that's my thinking, that they lack equity. And my thinking is that if they lack equity, it makes no sense to start new business with them without any equity. At the end of the day, what I want to appeal for is that banks should really consider to do too much business this time of the cycle in order to reduce the overall amount of new orders. So it's a natural thing if tier two and tier three names run out of equity, then they do not qualify for a ship financing at all. It sounds relatively fierce, but I think from somewhere the recovery of the industry has to start.
Are there any other contrary views to that?
I always find it difficult, you know, what is a tier one, tier two? I mean, to be honest, what we today sort of call tier three, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, that was definitely tier one, yeah? And it's the same management team. They still know how to run ships. And yes, their sort of financial situation have changed, but also, you know, everything that we call tier one, you know, they're also, everyone is financially stretched. Huh? There's very little companies that don't feel the pain today, whether it's tier one, tier two, three. I think if I look at ship finance deals now, you know, you look at the management team and you just look at the cash flows. If it works, then it works. The difficulty is that even for the very best ship owners, if you run your numbers, the numbers don't work. They can't pay any interest. There's no room. There's no cash flow.
Yes, can I give a comment on that? And we have seen within ship finance during the last, I would say, 5 to 10 years, the industry has become more financially professional, by using a much broader base of the capital market. And also the companies, to a certain degree, has become more both transparent and larger. And I think that trend will follow. And you will see that the larger, more industrial-focused companies with more transparent structures, strong management, strong corporate governance, that's the companies that will get access to the broad-based capital market. So it's a trend that is continuing. And in a downturn, it's more specific and clearer. But it's definitely a trend we will support. And I think it's important.
Chip at the right price. And personally, I wouldn't go too much for smaller ships, as I don't think that small ships are going to have a lot of years of good future, due to the fact that liner companies have decided since 3 years now that large is better, and so they're trying to, you know, grow the size of ships in every service. That they're achieving by doing the alliances and by doing the consolidations we just spoke to. And the fact that the Panama Canal has opened has made a lot of the Panamax ships, if not all, today useless to them. But that's for a short while. I think the Panamax ships are going to move down, they're going to cascade down and take over the demand that is there for smaller ships, which are not built, as we all know, and the fleet growth is negative. So I think that going forward, the Panamax is a year from now or so will start to improve their rates because they're going to start doing the business of what 3,000s do today, and hopefully cargoes are going to also improve slowly and fill up the ships. To find large ships, which would be my choice of investment in the container business, you cannot find many ships, maybe a couple of them, and if so, I'm not sure if they're going to be in good condition. So it's an obvious investment. You need balls, you need big balls, because right now it looks really dark. But you know, as Warren Buffett said, you should invest when people think you're crazy. So now it's the time, but there's not much liquidity in the container. So the dry bulk is the more obvious easy investment.
Thank you. And before wrapping up, I would like to open the floor for the rest of you to comment on this.
Yeah, if you would have asked me if it is the right time to invest into containers or in bulkers, I would have answered it's a good time to invest into tankers. And but anyhow, talking about investments into the container segment, I fully agree with George. I think especially the smaller vessels, that makes more sense, definitely. And if I look here into this large audience, and what do you expect from this conference, and what do you expect from Posidonia, I think is at least some good hints. And the panel before, there was one talking about a wise man he met yesterday. And I remember a story. There was a very successful ship owner in an interview, and the interviewer asked, sir, please tell me, what is the secret of your success in this business? And the successful ship owner said, just two words, right decisions. And the interviewer said, oh, that's very interesting. And how to make right decisions? And he answered, just one word, experience. Oh, okay. And please tell me how to get experience. And the ship owner said, just two words, wrong decisions.
Thank you. Any other brief comments? No. All right. Well, thank you very much.
For the industry, that it really comes up with then closer to, maybe we will never be an investment grade industry, but closer to a lower geared, better business model for the industry. So it's over time can really have access to capital.
It's obviously a trend in the comments that have been made that the smaller, under capitalized companies will be struggling. We've heard in a couple of the panels this morning about consolidation in different sectors. Do people think that the liquidity or lack of liquidity to those smaller companies of itself will lead to more consolidation?
I think it varies per segment. In dry bulk, you will probably see, I think large owners have struggled as much as small owners in the current very weak market. So the question is still out there, I think. But you will see that a larger part of the fleet will probably end up with the larger, well-capitalized owners. Is that consolidation or is it just shifting of fleets? I don't know. But if you look at the liner business, for instance, it's very clear that we are in the middle of a consolidation phase, and that will continue, if not accelerate, over the next 12 months, in my view, just as a couple of examples.
Shreyas, any thoughts on that?
Sorry. Christian, you want to go first? Go ahead.
No, on the liner side, we see a clear tendency towards consolidation. This is in order to reduce costs, because unfortunately the freight rates have not increased. With the smaller companies, we see a lot of consolidation, in particular in Germany. I expect a tremendous consolidation to be happen for whatever reasons, because the fleets become smaller, the ships become older, and in particular smaller companies do not have access to new management contracts for new ships. They do not have access to investors. Like Christian already said, you have to have a good story, a good equity story to attract investors. Otherwise, in the current situation, after eight years of crisis, many, many parties have more or less lost all their equity. Thus, it's necessary that you have access to equity, and if you don't have that, you will go down and you will have to stop your business, and this is then kind of consolidation.
Let's turn to the export credit agencies briefly. Over the last few years, having ECAs involved has been pretty much essential to get the large new building financings done. I just wondered what the panel felt about whether that was likely to continue going forward, and whether having an ECA in the structure throws up different structuring requirements or any particular difficulties in putting a deal together.
Should I take that one? I think it will continue. It has to continue. It's a force that has its own momentum. The reasons for the ECAs to be involved are bigger than just our industry. Obviously, there are governmental pressures. There are union pressures. There are labor market requirements. So I think it will continue. The structuring considerations have not changed. I mean, really, it's still the 12-year max, full payout type structures. You can negotiate some kind of what we would use to call a mismatch facility, so as to push out the profile. You could still do that. It adds time to the process. It's not as straightforward and simple as a bank facility. But the good news is that when you do large projects in rather embarrassed bank finance markets, there is somebody to go and write a big check, whether it's on a funded basis or a guaranteed basis. And especially in the cruise sector, you look at some of the big requirements in the billions of euros, where each ship is something like 700-800 million euros. It's a blessing to have them in. So we do welcome them, and we are strong partners with them. That's going to continue.
It's been a very important capital source for the industry for the last years, and hopefully there will not be that much new building. So the need, hopefully, will be to a certain extent also less. But they're also now into the first maybe big time challenges on restructurings. And that will be a testing case also for the ECA, how they will handle that situation. There are quite substantial amounts within the offshore industry, and they are now into what that means and how to make certain they are also part of the successful restructuring.
As a veteran of the container shipping restructuring saga from 2009 to 2014, I can tell you they are very commercial, but it does take time. Time is the enemy.
And it does change the whole dynamics in the restructuring, of course. It's not like that you put five commercial bankers in a room and hammer out a deal. No, it's much more complex than that. And indeed, time is an important factor.
Another source of funding, obviously, is private equity. There's been a lot of talk about private equity, and I just wondered how people view that, whether it's something you welcome in a structure, and how significant you think it is in today's market in coming up with the capital requirements of the owners. Bart, you're poised to go,
I
can see.
Push so I can answer this. I think, for me, private equity has been... I like working with private equity because it's a simple... The model is nice. They want to put money to work, so they like low leverage, which is good in this market. It works from a risk perspective. You know what you get. There's no sort of this is the structure. If new money needs to come in, then you sit down and they don't have to. There's no obligation to put more money in this structure. I like the negotiation as well. It's very professional. I look around the room and I know I had some tough discussions with a lot of people here, including backed by private equity. But it's predictable. That's what I like. But hasn't been good for the industry? That I'm not sure, because there's a lot of money that came in buying ships, ordering ships that really no one was no one needed. I mean, if you look at the VLGC, I think the over-ordering there has been, well, let me put it like this way, it hasn't been very good for the market, has it? And that was purely private equity money that came in.
We did see, as you said, a huge inflow of capital. But it's also, they have experience that the exit is not so easy. So basically, they came into dry bulk. They bought a secondary loan market, and the exit is not there. So it's part of going back to the industry, becoming more liquid, becoming more sophisticated, more professional. It's part of that. And then private equity is an important source of capital. And it's also a good test for companies. Are we good enough for that capital or not? So it all has to raise, how we raise the industry financially.
But they obviously have slightly different drivers and different time scales to a commercial bank. That must throw up some issues as well.
Yeah, but
it?
It's not replacing the other capital, but it's add to it. So it's just another source of funding. So yes, we have, as Bart is saying, you know what you get. It's a different horizon, different profile, but you know what you have. So you have to deal with that. For some, it might not be a good deal, but it gave a good dimension to the industry.
I think also what we've learned as sort of commercial bankers is that private equity is a very broad word, huh? And it covers hedge funds, long only, closed funds. And I think it's been a learning curve for all of us, understanding who's actually at the other side of the table, what their drivers are and their expectations in terms of exit, etc. So, yeah, I think we learned.
We have to distinguish between a restructuring situation and new business. When it comes to restructuring, private equity is very helpful because it enables, in many cases, a restructuring where nothing is left on the table. Then you might find a private equity fund and being very helpful. When it comes to new business, when it comes to new projects, it's, in my view, comparable. It has been comparable to the KG model. More or less replaced the KG models, and it enabled a lot of new builds, and thus, for the time being, I would be happy if the private equity money would go into distressed situations rather than in new orders.
Maybe we should turn to distressed situations or problem situations or whatever we want to call them. Clearly, even if you leave offshore out of it, the shipping market has its share of these difficulties at the moment. And I think one of the changes that I've seen over my career is banks are much less keen to go in and enforce and far more keen to look for a consensual restructuring. I wondered firstly if that is still the view, and secondly, what is the driver for you making that decision, whether it's a market-driven decision or your faith in the management and the underlying corporate?
I can give a first shot on that one. I think if you go then again 10, 15 years back, it was a one SPV and then asset financing. That was a different situation to to financing a company, a corporate, where you have bondholders, you have several banks, you have investors, and also might have a listed company. So it's many more partners at the table. So what the last thing you do is enforce. I mean, the first thing is you negotiate a plan, you try to find a solution. And that takes time. Like we now see in the offshore industry, it takes a long time to for all parties to grasp a seriousness and how deep it is, how long it will be, how challenging it is to find good solutions with all parties. And that, in a way, is a new situation. But then you don't go into, I mean, enforcing is like you have given up to finding a constructive solution. But it's much heavier to find a constructive solution when you have so many parties. But it's hopefully that is what will be a viable solution.
Well, it's a tribute to the fact that the quality of financial management of the average shipping company in the world has improved significantly over the past 15 to 20 years, because it is indeed possible to have a very very good dialogue in order to find a good solution. But you know, having the credible alternative of an enforcement behind you focuses people's minds as well, of course, to be totally honest.
I guess what doesn't work is when the counterparties, the owners, sponsors, take advantage of the large bank group or general dislocation within the bank direction to try and find angles that essentially work in their favor. I think that particular aspect is a rather ugly one of the overall restructuring discussions. Smaller groups, as Kristen said, smaller groups definitely easier to deal with. But I think typically when the outcome, when something positive has to happen, which is not under the control of the sponsors, such as the offshore industry, I mean, what can an owner do today to make drill rates go up, really? Nothing they can do, right? So what are you going to negotiate? All you can really negotiate is what horizon of time is this thing going to resolve itself over? And everybody's going to have different views. In the meantime, what cash has to be put in? How much cash does the guy have? I mean, that is really the core discussion here. So I think depends on the sector. There are some sectors where the restructurings might be a result of poor management, but the rest of the companies are doing well. Those are slightly easier to deal with.
And the well-publicized difficulties of having ECAs, private equity, bondholders, commercial banks, all in the same room, are there any pearls of wisdom any of you can shed on how best to tackle that? It's a terrible silence. But
I think common sense, I think, is the best one.
Yeah.
No, I think restructuring, you look at the management. So if a distress situation is the result of mismanagement, I'm completely with the rest of the group, and there's no point in staying with that sponsor, with that operator. But to be, you know, to echo what Guus is saying, the professionality of our counterparties have increased tremendously. So there's no point in forcefully taking the keys if you have a management team working with you. In fact, it just increases your loss.
But the more complicated it becomes with different stakeholders with different interests, it's almost an unnatural thing to do. But I think our experience is that it really pays off to early in the process appoint a neutral third-party advisor who can sort of keep all the, as we say in Dutch, frogs in the
kruiwagenbord.
The well in the pond.
And that focuses the discussion, and at the end of the process brings a lot of value, I think. But it can be intense and sometimes painful.
If I can add to that, I think, yes, I agree on that. But it's also a way, it's core that management, the company, drives the process, not sitting back, let advice, because that's also what we see now. It's like washing the hands, and you can have advisor competing, and, well, they didn't agree, so we didn't come to a solution. That's not how it should be. management has to take charge, and advisors are advising banks and the company. So I really find that core to success, that management still drives the process in the direction it should go.
Can I turn to the way banks handle restructurings internally? Because there's a mix, obviously, that some banks leave it largely with the initial relationship team, others have an entirely separate restructuring group, and some have a mix of the two. Whilst one can see the pros and cons, it's something, again, that stirs up quite strong feelings. So maybe we could just hear from each of the panel how they do it and why they've adopted that approach.
No,
we have taken the decision to distinguish between basic cases and very complex cases. As long as we have to do with a basic case, we do it completely from the relationship management side without involving our specialists from restructuring. Only if it's very complex, we ask our colleagues from restructuring to step in. This is, from my side, a good solution, because otherwise you might lose the contact with the company. For the company, the immediate transfer to the restructuring department might be a shock, and shocks are not always very good to find a good solution. And therefore, we stick to this model here. The final decision when it comes to a serious restructuring has to be taken by the people from the restructuring department when we're talking of a very complex situation, however.
So we're following the line, yeah? Well, first of all, there's some regulatory issues that you have to follow. So it's not just that the bank can decide, I will keep it in one hand. So there's a couple of strict rules. We're very lucky within DVB that sort of the embedded shipping knowledge is everywhere. So whether it's in our workout team or in the relationship, everyone, you know, from the top to the bottom knows shipping. So we don't lose much in terms of knowledge and client knowledge. But you know, we have to follow some rules. So sometimes we have to give it to the specialized workout team. They work closely with the relationship managers, but the embedded know-how of the clients are always there.
We have organized a special unit within shipping division. So within the responsibility of the shipping division. And you can, there's like a step one and a step two. Step one, early phase. Step two is more challenging situation. And that's when that team comes in and might take over. But they are on the teams for all the cases which are relevant. What we have decided, it is should be within that division, because we have to think through, where do we want to be in 5 years? How do we enable, we keep relationship where it's where we want to keep them, and we keep the restructuring cases on within the area where we have the shipping and offshore knowledge. So it's very tight the way we organize it.
To clients who are going through restructuring, I would say treat your restructuring partner as your relationship manager, kind of level of intimacy. I would not distance anyone simply because they carry a different business card. It is only to your advantage to get to know these people as well as possible. It's almost like you're ill and there's a doctor coming to see you. Why would you not cooperate? There are some restructuring people who are very harsh and unreasonable, but it's the relationship manager's job to make that communication easier and open between the client and the restructuring person. The best restructurings have always been ones which have involved clear communication, written communication from day one. None of this side negotiation with the relationship manager and then relying on the relationship manager to fill in some gaps with the restructuring team. That does not work. You have to be direct and communicate clearly. This sounds very basic, but really they're all human beings. I mean, that's all what we thrive on. And all the restructuring manager wants to do is to give the client back to the relationship manager, because they have other things to do as well.
Yeah, exactly. That's a very important point. Relationship manager has many clients and has to take care of all of them, so it's very difficult for him or her to focus on a specific case, whereas the restructuring officer can spend his entire day and night very often on on specific projects, and that that really helps in getting a quick and good solution.
Okay, thank you. Well, we don't want to spend too long on restructuring. Let's try and end with something a bit more optimistic. We started by saying how deals for good names are being fought for, if you like, by the banks. The banks have got the appetite to do those deals, but there aren't so many of them around. Volumes of bank lending in the shipping market are quite severely down on 12 months ago. So I was just interested to hear people's views as to what the second half of the year might bring, whether people will be very distracted with the issues in the offshore industry, or whether there's a lot of new business to be done as well. Let's start from this end for a change.
Well, there is, yes, volumes are down from previous years, but there is still quite a bit of business, and we're taking our fair share of that. If you look ahead for the next, and there's, for instance, a lot of activity in the tanker market. If you look ahead for the next 12 months, one of the things that is very sort of apparent is that many of the deals that have been done in the 2011-2012 period, which all have maturities of 5 years, are coming up for refinance pretty soon. And some of the banks that are in those deals are probably not very keen to continue in a refinancing. So I think that is a big sort of mountain of refinance of deals to be done, which is coming up in almost all sectors where you look. And then of course there's the anti-cyclical lending. For instance, look at dry bulk. Bart said rightfully, of course, there's no cash flows today in a dry bulk project to support any debt. But you may be able to start taking a view on the asset, on the anti-cyclical approach. And therefore, I think we will see some very conservative, really asset-based deals in dry bulk as well in the next few months.
And good point on refinancings. I think I'm a very fortunate child to have a large nursery with lots of toys in it. And I'm going to play with securitization, I think, latter half. Commodity hedging, as I mentioned earlier, is going to continue to be a focus. And certainly on the asset finance side, the sectors are going to be cruise, LNG, and container shipping. I think those are going to be interesting for us. But we don't see a reduction in how much revenue we would make. I think it will just be different sources.
I think that's a very important point, that we are not just lending. We are doing all the broad-based advising and capital sourcing for the companies. And there's always a need for refinancing, restructuring, and that's good business. And some banks are leaving, some's coming in, finding new capital, finding new sources, trimming the balance. It's being a good financial advisor. You find solutions for the company. So it might not be like a number of transactions, but it can be as good business.
So what I see for the rest of the year, we have a prepayment sort of amortization churn of around, you know, high 20s, close to 30%. So we have to run to stand still if it comes to the portfolio. As Guus says, there's a lot of refinancing coming up, and with, you know, some banks more hesitant, I think for DVB it's a great opportunity to actually, you know, pick up those transactions. But in general, if I look forward for the rest of the year, I think it will be for real new business, it will be very slow. I mean, I'm talking senior debt stuff, yeah, not the advisory stuff. It will be a slow year. And if I will be an investor, if I look around the sort of the table here, you can wait until tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, the deals will still be there, and perhaps they're actually better. So I wouldn't be in a hurry if I were you at this table here.
Yeah, I see a slow year in total. However, with the second part of the year to be more active, we will see definitely join a number of consolidations in the market where fleets or ships are about to be transferred from one owner to the other. Due to the fact that we know more or less all of the owners, this is potential business for us. Asset-wise, I see more activity on the dry side. When you talk to the people, many people look at the dry side being a good counter-cyclical opportunity to invest. And coming from Germany, I see always some fantasy in the smaller container ships.
Thank you. I think we're about out of time, so on that happy and slightly light-hearted note, I'd just like to thank all the panel for their contributions this morning. Thank you. Thank you.